Today on Straight Talk Africa, a conversation on the significance of the role of the African Union mission in Somalia, known as AMISOM. Black Hawks Rising is a book written by Dr. Opio Oloya, covering 2007 to 2014. That's coming up next right here on Straight Talk Africa. Hello, welcome to Straight Talk Africa, live from the Voice of America studios here in Washington. It's Wednesday, September 28th. I am Shaka Sali.
Well, hello to you, Shaka, and hello to all our viewers and listeners on the continent and elsewhere. I'm Mariama Diallo, your social media reporter.
Today, it's a conversation on a new book, Black Hawks Rising, the story of the African Union peacekeeping mission in Somalia.
And coming up later in our STA inbox, we'll share your questions and comments on the book. That's through your emails, tweets, and Facebook posts. That's ahead on Straight Talk Africa. Hope you'll stay with us.
Today, my colleague Paul Sisko takes a look at the story of the courageous men and women peacekeeping in Somalia.
The name of the book is Black Hawks Rising, the story of AMISOM's successful war against Somali insurgents 2007 to 2014. Not everyone agrees the mission has been a success, but author Opio Oloya does. A Black Hawk is a military helicopter, and the book references a somewhat failed U.S. military operation in Somalia in 1993. A rescue mission that some believe led to America's delay or failure to intervene in later conflicts on the continent, such as the Rwandan genocide of 1994. In many cultures, African cultures, the hawk is a symbol of protection. Black Hawks Rising refers to African peacekeepers in Somalia. The African Union mission in Somalia is a regional peacekeeping effort and force operated by the African Union with the approval of the United Nations Security Council. It was created by the AU in January 2007. A month later, the UN approved its mandate to support the transitional government in Somalia, train security forces, implement a security plan, and help Somali forces battle al-Shabaab militants terrorizing the state. Initially, the African peacekeeping mission was confined to the beleaguered Somali capital, Mogadishu. AMISOM took on the Somali insurgents as a fighting force in 2010, expelling them from central Mogadishu in early August 2011, and later expanded control of territory under the Somali government in succeeding years to most of Somalia. Early, the United States, under the administration of George Bush, strongly opposed the deployment of peacekeepers to Somalia. As late as 2009, President Obama's UN ambassador designate told the Senate Foreign Relations Committee she too has concerns.
I am skeptical too about the wisdom of a United Nations peacekeeping force in Somalia at this time.
Eventually, the Bush administration lent support to deployment of regional troops in Somalia. Today, Somalia is still plagued by deadly guerrilla attacks and suicide bombings at the hands of al-Shabaab and other terrorist groups. 2 weeks ago, President Mahmoud Hassan Sheikh Mahmoud hosted a regional conference in Mogadishu for the first time in ages. Evidence, he says, that Somalia's years of anarchy are waning, and there is progress on security and peace building under his governance. Regional leaders say they expect free and fair elections in Somalia later this year. President Mahmoud told them his government is rebuilding the national army and praised AMISOM for providing protection for Somali governments for nearly a decade. Today, there are over 22,000 AMISOM troops and police in Somalia, many trained by the United States, Canada, Great Britain, and Turkey. Uganda currently provides the largest contingent of AMISOM troops, about one-third of the total African force. Burundi has over 5,000 troops in Somalia, Ethiopia more than 4,000, 3,600 from Kenya, 1,000 from Djibouti, and 850 from Sierra Leone, and other smaller African troop contributions. The European Union provides most of the resources for the fighting force. Despite the much improved conditions and security in Mogadishu and across Somalia, elections, which were slated for last weekend, have been postponed again. Parliamentary elections are being pushed back to October 23rd, and the presidential vote has been rescheduled for November 30th. Meanwhile, devastating food shortages in the Horn of Africa continue to spread. According to the United Nations, 5 million people in Somalia, and the numbers are growing, including 300,000 children, are malnourished. Paul Sisko, VOA News, Washington.
Thanks, Paul, for that report. Joining us here in our Washington studio is our distinguished guest, Dr. Opiyo Oloya himself, an educator, researcher, and author. I have to say, my brother, that I'm profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to host you on Straight Talk Africa for the first time.
Thank you. Thank you, Shaka. I am happy to be here in D.C. A little bit rainy today, but I think it is okay.
It's a pleasure, of course, to see you in the studios. And, of course, Milton Alimadi, founding publisher and editor, Black Star News. He joins us from our VOA studios in New York. It's always a pleasure, of course, to host you on Straight Talk Africa, Milton Alimadi.
Hey, my pleasure, Ndugu Shaka. And greetings to your guest in the studio as well, Brother Opiyo Oloya.
Hello, Milton. How are you?
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's very interesting. I don't know whether it's a coincidence, but I gather that you too come from the same major area known as Gulu.
Yes, we do.
Absolutely.
Yes, we do.
We both grew up eating kwan.
Kwan, to be specific.
And probably malakwang.
Malakwang, yes, yeah. Of course.
Later,
absolutely.
Later in the program, we'll give you, the audience, a chance to call and talk with our guests. The number to call is 202-619-3111, and the U.S. country code is 1. Let me come to you immediately. The kid from Arero who made good.
Yes, thank you.
First of all, frankly, I have to say congratulations because you've written an incredibly interesting book.
Thank you.
Very well researched. Mm-hmm. Looks to be very factual. But you seem to have had a very rare opportunity as a writer or as a journalist for that matter. You seem to have had unfettered access almost to anything, frankly, anybody would be dreaming about.
True. My involvement with this research, I need to give you a little bit of background here, mm-hmm. Shaka. When the African Union decided that they were going to send a mission, and then, of course, the UN Security Council authorized that in February of 2007, mm-hmm. when I read that, I immediately said, oh my goodness, this is not gonna work. Americans were there in 1993, it did not end well. And so now we are gonna send Africans? Like, why? Why do you want to do this? This is going to be bad. So I wrote a piece, and in the piece, I said, the troops, the African troops going to Somalia are going to be dead on arrival.
Dead on arrival.
DOA. So that was, any writer, you write your piece and then you forget about it.
Interesting.
And so I forgot all about this.
You know, it is very interesting that you say that because December of 2006.
Yes.
I happened to be a resident in the Addis Ababa Sheraton.
Okay.
And Meles Zenawi, the then Prime Minister, was addressing the nation.
Right.
His troops were entering Somalia.
This would have been around December 6th.
A little bit later,
yes, yeah, yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It was very interesting.
Yes. And so when Ethiopians troops went in, mm-hmm. there was this massive response from the Somali public. Look, these people have been enemies for some time. And to have Ethiopian troops in Somalia immediately mm-hmm. created mm-hmm. this nationalistic feeling among mm-hmm. the Somali are very proud people. Hmm. And so that generated what became an insurgency. The question then was, could Zenawi sustain that? And he didn't want these troops to stay there for very long. They were already taking a lot of casualties.
That is
even
correct.
As early as January of 2007. In fact,
people will tell you that whenever Ethiopia crosses the line, goes into Somalia, it eventually triggers unity inside the country against Ethiopia.
And this is exactly what happened. So then, African Union is now coming in and say, okay, what can we do? And the idea of sending AMISOM, mm-hmm. which had been there for some time in a different form, mm-hmm. but now, you know, it really took some urgency, you know, because Ethiopians might pull out, and so there is going to be a vacuum. Mm. And so when the United Nations authorized this force, I wrote about it. Fast forward to 2010, August. Mm-hmm. I met the current Chief of Defense Forces of Uganda, you know, General Wamala Katumba, in a restaurant in Kampala.
Ike Tobero.
Mm-hmm. I just went to eat, you know, matoke and ebenyewa.
I like going there too, yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's a fine restaurant. Mm-hmm. Anyhow, by the way, you know, do you know what is happening in Somalia? I should show you. So he said, look, you said in long ago, 3 years ago, that we are going to be dead on arrival. We are still there. We are making progress. And he showed me some video. And in the video, it wasn't really about fighting. But in fact, you see Ugandan troops interacting mm-hmm. with the Somali civilians, in you know, providing water, providing medicine, clinics, and so on. And he said, you know, that is how we are trying to get in there.
But from what you have seen, of course, you've talked with a lot of people.
Right,
do you think
right.
it was a good idea at the time for the Ugandan president to make the decision to send UPDF in Somalia under those prevailing circumstances?
Let me put it this way. Somebody had to go in there because the situation had become terrible mm-hmm. For the Somali civilians. The insurgency, within a very short time, gained so much strength. I would say within weeks, mm-hmm. within 2 weeks, mm-hmm. you know, from around January 1st, 2007 to about the middle of January, the insurgency had increased. And so you had the making of a real catastrophe, you know. And so somebody had to go in there. The reason that Uganda was probably more ready than other African countries is because, as chairman of the intergovernmental authority,
IGAD,
mm-hmm. Museveni had all along wanted to help support the federal government of Abdullahi Hamid, mm-hmm. you know, in Baidoa, and he had troops ready to go, and so when the call came, you know, we need support. Mm-hmm. He was able to, he was in place. So it wasn't a question of, you know, is it a wise idea or not a wise idea? Of course, other African countries said, you know, no, thank you. We are not going.
In fact, I remember having a conversation with the then Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, Dr. Jindai Fraser. She told me that several African countries had pledged troops, including, of course, Nigeria, including Malawi, Sierra Leone.
I covered that in my book, Black Hawks Rising, yes.
Yeah, but when it came to actually walk the talk,
they never did.
They developed cold feet. Their argument being, I was told by a former Nigerian president, that they didn't think, frankly, there was any peace to keep because they didn't want their soldiers to become sitting ducks.
And in fact, I would say that when you read my book, you'll find that Uganda also had to transition because when they went there, they were given the full authority to be able to protect themselves, mm-hmm, of course, mm-hmm. under Article 7 of you know, of the Security Council. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, they still went with the idea of peacekeeping. But when they realized that there was no peace to keep, now they had to transition now into a peacemaking force, one that was able to meet fire with fire when the occasion arose. You see, and that took place very quickly. Anyway, so General Wamala Katumba invites me to go to Mogadishu, mm-hmm. and I end up in Mogadishu in August of 2010.
Had you ever been a soldier or lawyer?
No.
So where do you get the courage to go to a frontline like that?
You know, my wife said, you are very stupid to be there. You know, like, what are you doing there? You know, we had agreed with Katumba that I would not tell my wife until we land in Mogadishu. Then I'll call and say, guess where I am now? And say, where are you? I said, you know, I'm in Mogadishu.
Were you trying to become a more, you remember Muhammad Amin?
Muhammad Amin, which one, this one?
Of Kenya, of Nairobi.
Oh, okay.
The great African photojournalist.
Yes, yes.
Huh?
No.
I see.
Yeah.
Well, we have to go for a break. Now we'll pause for a short break and would like to remind you that Straight Talk Africa is now on the social networking website, Twitter. And we are tweeting live. Follow us at VOA Shaka, that's VOA Shaka. and join in on today's discussion with your questions and comments. Don't forget to use the hashtag VOA Black Hawks Rising. And we are still on Facebook. Just enter the keyword Straight Talk Africa. Become a fan and connect with other friends of the Voice of America. We'll be right back with you, so please, don't go away.
We are able to touch on things that are important to people on an everyday basis. We hope that our viewers are getting inspired when they watch our show. They're getting a view of the world from a different perspective, things that perhaps are not in their immediate vicinity. Today, I could put in on the show something that is a little different, a little unique, and this gives me that inspiration to come to work.
This is Straight Talk Africa on the Voice of America. What is your opinion about today's topic? Call us at 202-619-3111. U.S. country code 1. When you call, remember the following. Ask only one question. Keep your comment brief and turn down the volume on your radio or television. Now let's return to Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you very much, Esther Gidiyuwat. And of course, this is Straight Talk Africa, coming to you live from Washington. Milton, are you there?
Yes, I'm here, Ndugu.
How are you?
I'm quite, thank you. Thanks for hosting me again.
Oh, you're most welcome. It's been, in fact, a very, very long time since I hosted you personally.
Absolutely. Before you went to the continent and came back.
That is correct. That is correct. Let me ask you this question, Wilson. Of course, you had us chat here. And you followed the story very, very closely. Do you think that it was a good judgment call to send Ugandan troops at that time to Somalia?
Well, I think I agree with the author that the situation was extremely dire at that time. The Somali people were suffering immensely, and to some extent, they continue to suffer. So something had to be done. I think the mission should have been much more robust, and it should have involved more African countries. Because quite frankly, unfortunately, it's not seen so much as an African mission today. It's seen pretty much like a Ugandan mission. And I think that has some challenges, and it poses some problems at the same time. We have seen on several instances where General Museveni has played the Somalia card and used it to gain diplomatic advantage. So let me give you a few examples. When the United Nations came out with a critical report concerning Uganda's involvement in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, the mapping report implicated Uganda in human rights abuses. The Ugandan regime threatened to withdraw its contingent from Somalia. On another occasion, when the United Nations implicated Uganda in training, financing M23, the militia that caused much havoc and destruction and deaths in eastern Congo, Uganda again threatened to withdraw its contingent from Somalia. It's happened on numerous occasions, most recently after the disputed February elections, when the international observers came out with the conclusion that the elections were not free, fair, or credible, and the United States seemed to support that conclusion. Once again, what did Uganda do? Threatened to withdraw from Somalia. So the Ugandan regime has been abusing that operation, which is very unfortunate because, quite frankly, Somalia does need assistance. It needs a robust intervention. I would hope more African countries would become involved. And most importantly, Shaka, and I suppose the author might agree with this, there should be an exit strategy. It cannot be an open-ended intervention. Uganda's been there for how many years now? We're going on to a decade. For how many more years will Uganda remain there? Because even though the book may document the successful part of it, I wonder how the soldiers on the ground actually feel. I'm sure there must be fatigue. We are familiar with U.S. soldiers who are deployed in Iraq or Afghanistan, and when they come back, they have problems, including mental issues, Of course, many of them lose their limbs. Many of them actually lose their lives during the operation. Do we get to hear the story of the Ugandan soldiers in the book as well? Do we actually hear from the fighting men and how they feel, as opposed to only the government side of this intervention?
Very interesting. You raised two very significant points here. You talk, of course, about how Ugandan president may have used his troops in Somalia politically, in the sense that he has threatened the international community, a sort of blackmail, really.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But you also raise, of course, the other important issue of no exit strategy. What about some observers who have suggested that part of the reason is, in fact, it has turned out to be a cash cow?
Yes, obviously, that's the other aspect that I wanted to mention as well. There have been many reports that a significant part of the money which comes from the international community to support this operation actually does not get to the fighting men on the ground. A significant part of it is allegedly embezzled by senior officers in the military. Yeah. And that, in fact, some of the equipment are not even deployed to the men who need it on the ground. And there's a very interesting article in the East African by Daniel Kalikani, which is, I think, was published on Monday. And it details an incident where Ugandan actually lost about 20 troops because they had inadequate communication and inadequate supplies, which should have been available to them.
I see, yeah. I see. Now, how do you respond to that?
There are a few things, though, that I think I need to correct, at least not supported by my research. And I did a lot of work. Mm. Now, first and foremost, I was in Somalia in July this year. Mm. And when I am in Somalia, as
I remember, you sent me an email,
right?
And I tried to reach you, but I couldn't.
You couldn't because the telephone there is not always available. But in terms of my interaction with troops, and I am yes, I do have access to the troops. Mm-hmm. I'm not stage managed around. You know, somebody stage managing where I go. I go where I want to go.
Right, but you agree that you are embedded.
Well, yes, because you need protection.
They provide you logistics.
They have to provide me with logistics for protection. That I agree. But what I want to
say. What about the people you talk to?
No, I talk to anybody that I want. Absolutely, nobody will tell me don't talk to so and so, or stage managing. No, that doesn't happen.
I see in the book that you have largely talked to the commanders, really.
The commanders, but also to the troops themselves.
Some of the troops, yes,
in the front line.
For example, give us a specific example of, say, like a private soldier.
Yes.
A corporal or a sergeant that you interacted with?
Oh, I interacted with many. For example, there was the attack of December 2014, I believe it was. Mm. This is the attack that entered the Alane base, where Al-Shabaab had about three or four, men come in and disguised as workers. Mm. And then they attacked the officer's mess. Mm. In fact, this is the officer's mess where when I go, I do it with the soldiers.
They have officer's mess there?
They do have
but
officer's mess.
But there's no mess. Officer's mess culture in Uganda.
Well, they do.
not in Uganda. During my days when I was in the army, there was.
Maybe in your days, I believe that they do officer's mess. But anyhow, the point I wanted to make was that the attack was put down by the ordinary soldiers. So, I talked to them, like, what happened? So they have to describe to me, at the beginning, they had to mobilize themselves. They had to find a way to neutralize these insurgents who are now right inside the camp itself. Mm. In the end, it was, one of the soldiers who took them out. You see,
but without taking anything away from the Uganda People's Defense
Force. But,
Shaka,
if I may respond first, because there are a couple of things. Number one, the equipment and supplies of equipment is managed by United Nations Support Office for AMISOM.
Correct.
Okay, so it
you
is.
That in the book.
Absolutely,
yes.
And it is not right or correct to suggest that somehow Ugandan commanders are keeping equipment away from their soldiers. That is not true.
But isn't it true, by the way, for example, that some international partners who are supposed to provide that type of equipment, sometimes they have not, in fact, delivered?
Well, certainly there could be better equipment.
You read something like that in the book?
Actually, in my visit...
Brigadier Kavuma. Brigadier Kavuma, in fact, is raising that issue.
He does raise it in the article that mm-hmm. came out this Monday, yes, that they need equipment. But the equipment is coming through ANSOR, United Support Office for AMISOM. They mm-hmm. are the one who are in charge of logistics. I had occasion to make an appointment to meet with the head of ANSOR, the director of ANSOR, you know, Mr. Kamara, in Mogadishu this July. Because what I wanted to tell him was, I have seen that many of the equipment, many of the vehicles are now getting, you know, they are getting dilapidated.
Right.
Unfortunately, I didn't meet with him.
Do soldiers get 3 meals a day?
Soldiers do eat well.
They're taken very well. They're taken care of. How is their morale?
The morale is very good. Again, that was another point I wanted to make. When I talk to soldiers, because, you know, soldiers are free when they see that you're free with them, they will tell you. If they're not happy, they'll tell you, we are not happy here. You know, they will tell you, okay? They are very motivated. They are still doing their work. They do it very well. They do it very professionally. They are working with Somali civilians. So you know, to say that somehow they are now discouraged and so on, that I did not see. At least I have to be upfront about this.
I see.
Yeah.
Go ahead. You have 2 minutes. Yes, please.
Okay. I wanted to say, first of all, this book is tremendously important. It adds to the body of knowledge and history that we need to document. But at the same time, I think the author might agree that it's sometimes very difficult for a writer to have that distance when you're embedded. So while it's welcome that that's one way to get to talk to the troops, I would imagine that the troops might probably tell Brother Pio Loya something different if he had been able to go there independently and not being as seen as attached to the Ugandan military establishment or the senior officers. Obviously, troops talk to you, but they also fear there might be consequences from the officers after you leave. So I think that's a reasonable assumption. And that's not to take anything else from the book. I think the book is a useful contribution to something that needs to be documented.
How different is that from, of course, the concern is that sometimes public poll, you know, analysts find themselves in when they go to a country like Uganda. They sometimes find it difficult to get, you know, really, opinions, frankly, that are independent, precisely because some members in society do not feel reasonably free.
Right. No, I think if you are next, and I agree with Mr. Alimadi, you know, he is a very good researcher. You know, I read some of his stuff.
And a very good writer.
And a very good writer.
And you too.
Thank you.
And you too, right.
Thank you. But, you know, and so he knows that, yes, sometimes you need to be able to shift through. You know, as a writer, you gather your material. I had lots of material that could probably fill 3 or 4 books. I couldn't put them all in, you know, in one book.
Should we expect part two?
I don't know that. But but what I'm trying to say is that as an experienced researcher and writer, and I'm just not just talking about somebody who is just going there to gather a few little facts and then publish it in a newspaper article. I'm talking about the kind of research that Alimadi does, the kind of research that you do and I do. You take your time and you shift through. So, yes, there will be people who might be, you know, will couch their conversation in a way that you know, they are afraid. But you get, at the end, you get to the kernel of the truth. You are able to tease out what, you know, what you know must be at the truth. And so when I go to Somalia and I talk to these troops, number one, as I say, I'm unfettered. I go where, I name where I want to go.
Was your goal to cover the UPDF or was it, in fact, to cover AMISOM? And if it was AMISOM, do you feel like you did an adequate job on that? Because what comes through is UPDF.
More UPDF, yes. Now, you mentioned a very good point, because access to the other troop contributing, the troops from the other nations, Burundi, Kenya,
Djibouti,
Ethiopia, was very difficult. You know, Kenya was, you know, in
Kismayo.
And Ethiopia in Baidoa area, Djibouti somewhere else. So covering that was very difficult. So,
we'll,
yes,
we'll come to that.
Yeah.
You are tuned into Straight Talk Africa. We have more of a discussion in a moment, but first here is Mariama Jaro. Take it away, Mariama.
Well, thanks, Shaka. Still to come, we'll reveal some of the fantastic feedback we've received from our audience through social media. Our discussion continues in a moment. Stay with us.
Today's youth are not just the next generation of African leaders. They are today's leaders. And this is the time to invest in them. Today, not tomorrow. So let's connect. Let's engage with each other on issues that will transform our societies. Innovation, leadership, entrepreneurship, things that you're doing to move the continent forward to make you the greatest generation that Africa has known. It's Upfront every Wednesday, 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
This is Straight Talk Africa on The Voice of America. Call us now with your questions and comments. The number is 202-619-3111 and the U.S. country code is 1. Call us direct and we'll call you right back. Remember to turn down the volume on your radio or television and keep your comments brief. Now back to Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you very much, Esther Githu-Ewart, and welcome back to Straight Talk Africa, live from Washington. Once again, it's time to bring in my colleague and social media reporter, Mariama. Take it away again, Mariama.
Well, thanks, Shaka. If you are just joining the conversation, we are talking with author Opiyo Oloya about his book, Black Hawks Rising, the story of AMISOM's successful war against Somali insurgents, 2007 and 2014, between that time. The book tells the story of the formation and deployment of the African Union mission to Somalia and leads us to our question of the week, which says, what would you like to ask the author about his book? Well, starting off the conversation is a viewer from Nigeria with our letter of the week.
Omunua Okugbo Igodalo from Nigeria writes, the book raises a number of questions. First, is Dr. Oloya merely being optimistic while ignoring the hard realities on the ground in Somalia? Did he offer practical pieces of advice on how Somalia can raise charismatic and transformational leaders? Has he given realistic pieces of advice on how Somalis can see themselves as brothers and sisters so that devastating wars do not occur anymore in their country? In the face of all these questions, one must thank him for writing this book.
Well, that was Omunuo Okugbo Igodalo from Nigeria. Once again, I'd like to thank all of you for using all our social media platform to communicate with us. And another reminder that we are tweeting live today. Just use the hashtag VOA Black Hawks Rising. And if you haven't yet, do follow us at VOA Shaka. Now let's go to a tweet from Emmanuel Kachele, who asked this question. He says, a root question for him is, who supplies financial and military assistance to Al-Shabaab? Well, we have another one, this time from Martin Nyalusi, who tweets, I think AMISOM in Somalia has failed to retain peace, but let us ask yourselves, where does Al-Shabaab get weapons from? Well, now to a Facebook comment, this time from Nim Rogers in Uganda, who writes, what are the social implications of Dr. Oloya's book to the African continent? Well, Dr. Oloya, there you go. You have very interesting questions in here. Your take.
Well, what about that? It's all yours. Go for it.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, first to the viewer from Nigeria, Omunua, thank you very much. No, I think you raised very important points. The issue here is what is going to happen to Somalia, you know, in the next, you know, 1 year, 4 years, and so on. Am I being overly optimistic? No, when I wrote the book, I was looking at, number one, where Somalia came from. Somalia came from a difficult place, a place where there was absolutely no organized government. And so when AMISOM went in there, first and foremost, they had to move Al-Shabaab, the insurgents, out of Mogadishu and then from the rest of the country. Begin to allow the transitional federal government to begin to function as a semblance of a government. You know, it took time. And over time, we are beginning to see Somalia really gaining some ground. I went back this July, and I can tell you, you know, every time I go, I've been going since 2010 every year. And every year, I notice something different. This year, the thing that I noticed that you might take for granted in Nigeria are the petrol stations. They are everywhere. And I ask myself, why doesn't Al-Shabaab blow them up? I mean, they are not protected, but they are there. It shows the confidence that the Somali people are beginning to have in their environment. So things are beginning to look up. Yes, I'm optimistic that Somalia is slowly turning, you know, turning the corner. Not there yet. There's still a lot to do. The government is sustained by AMISOM. Let us be realistic about that. If AMISOM is not there, that is not going to work. So yes, I'm optimistic, but I'm also realistic. I think Emmanuel was asking about the source of funding for Al-Shabaab. Al-Shabaab is a scattered force right now, but they still have a lot of sympathetic people who provide them with money. Now, you have to remember, there are spaces within Somalia where Al-Shabaab has control, small towns. They still have control, so they collect money. They collect money from people, you know? And so that's, you know, part of it. And then, of course, there are remittances. There are people who are, you know, overseas, who do find ways to send money to Al-Shabaab.
People that pay taxes.
Yes, this is there. And so, you know, so Al-Shabaab is able to have at least money funds flowing in and to be able to find weapons, which was the next question, where do they get their weapons from? The borders along Ethiopia, with the borders with Djibouti, those are very porous borders. Mm. People are able to walk through and smuggle weapons in. Now, there is no evidence to suggest that Eritrea, for example, is supporting Al-Shabaab in its current form. But there may be individual actors within Eritrea right now who continue to supply weapons to Al-Shabaab. And then let us not forget that they have had 4 attacks against African Union forces, against the Burundians, the Ugandans, against the Kenyans. And each time they did that, they were able to walk away with some weaponry.
I see. Well, let's go to another comment. Well, Mariama.
You're absolutely right.
Any more reaction from Facebook comments, please?
Absolutely. We'll go to Othin Jeremiah, who writes that as the book Black Hawks Rising captures the stories of those brave people behind AMISOM, what is the best lesson we can learn from those people? And one more post while we're at it, this time from Nukula Herbert Wairagara Jr. He asked, is there an invisible hand behind his authoring this book? I hope he talks about some of the negatives of AMISOM as well. Well, Dr. Oloya, once again, your thoughts. And I also wanted to add that many people did ask, where can they get the book?
But I think that we should really give a chance to Milton to respond, and then you can add up.
Fair enough.
Milton, how do you respond to that?
Well, I would just like to build on what Dr. Oloya said. I think nobody can deny that Somalia has come a long way from where it was 10, 15 years ago, or 20 years ago after the collapse of Siad Barre.
So great credits to Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni and the UPDF for having pioneered the effort.
Yes. Absolutely. As I said, you know, the soldiers need to get the credit where they deserve, and yes, I think this book does credit to them.
Yes.
But on the other hand, in order to build on the success, I think the operation needs to be expanded. It should not be seen as identified exclusively with Uganda. General Museveni alone cannot put sufficient pressure on the Somali political players that you need to resolve your politics so eventually all African soldiers can go home. I think if you have more African countries involved,
yes,
including maybe South Africa, including Nigeria, including Ghana, they can put collective pressure on the Somali players on the ground to resolve their politics so that the troops can go home, because that ultimately has to be the ultimate solution. We can't have an open-ended operation where Uganda is still there for another 5, 10, 15 years.
You know,
that's untenable.
It's very interesting. It may look simple, but now that I can see, it must be very, very important, because I remember back in 1996, I was told by the late Dr. Hassan Al-Turabi,
mm-hmm.
that Yoweri Museveni one time had told him that his ancestors came from a land called Kush,
mm-hmm.
which obviously is around the present day Sudan and Somalia and mm-hmm. what have you.
Mm-hmm.
No wonder it was Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni who was the first African leader, in fact, mm-hmm. to step on Somali soil during the post-Siad Barre time.
I believe it was in November 1992. Either October or November 1992, when Museveni went into Somalia.
Mm.
No, but I want to point out, you know, that really this is not just about Museveni.
No, we'll come back to that.
We'll come back to that.
Well, thanks, Mariama, for bringing us this week's audience reaction.
And hopefully Dr. Oloya will be able to tell our viewers, listeners, readers, where they can eventually get this book. Well, that will do it for today's social media segment. Just a reminder that we appreciate all the feedback, whether it's in social media form or using other means to communicate to us. Please keep them coming. And if you are a new fan, just drop us a line at africatv@voanews.com. Once again, our email address is africatv@voanews.com. Or post your comment on our Facebook page. Just enter the keywords Straight Talk Africa. Be sure to visit us online at voaafrica.com, or you can join our YouTube channel. Sign up to VOA TV to Africa, and don't forget to follow us on Twitter. Another reminder that the show is streaming live every Wednesday. Just go to the VOA Straight Talk Africa TV program page on our website, or simply watch us live on your mobile device. Just download the VOA mobile app. Well, now let's take a look at what's on tap for next week's program.
Next week on Straight Talk Africa, former South Sudan Vice President Riek Machar is calling for an armed struggle against the government of President Salva Kiir, a move that could mark a renewal of the country's civil war. We'll discuss the new developments in South Sudan next week, right here on Straight Talk Africa.
Welcome back to a conversation on a new book, Black Hawks Rising, the story of the African Union peacekeeping mission in Somalia. Our distinguished guests are Dr. Opiyo Oloya, educator, researcher, and author, and Milton Alimadi, founding publisher and editor, Black Star News, who joins us from New York. Well, I have to say again, gentlemen, how profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled I am to have the opportunity to host the two of you on Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you. Well,
my pleasure.
You're most welcome.
Shaka, as I was saying, you know, one of the viewers asked the question about what could we learn from the experience of the men and women who have been working so hard for almost a decade now. It'll be a decade next March 2017 in Somalia. I think what, for me, the takeaway home is this, that we can do it. For far too long, conflict in Africa had to be moderated or, you know, worked upon by those from us, either from America would be leading the mission, or European would, you know, you have France in Mali, you know, the Saval
mission. Just in the same way that the 1884 Berlin Conference.
You see, so
under Chancellor Bismarck.
But AMISOM for me was what excites me is that AMISOM is different. This is an African-led mission.
It is very good that it is an African-led mission. But what about the funding? They say that whoever pays the piper, my friend, calls the tune.
Fair enough. This is where I think the United Nations at its finest, because I'm very critical of United Nations missions, and there are about nine of them right now in various forms in Africa. You know, you've got United Nations mission in South Sudan. You've got UNAMID in Darfur. You've got MINUSCA and so on, and MONUSCO in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Each of them about $1 billion apiece.
The largest, perhaps, peacekeeping mission in the world.
I'm telling you. And so I've never been a fan of that kind of, you know, yes. But for me, United Nations being able to gather funding from, you know, European Union, from the United States of America, gathering partners and channeling the funds to AMISOM, this to me is the way to do it. The international community cannot escape its role.
You know, in the 1960s, before a man called Dr. Kwame Nkrumah was overthrown, having been a founding member of the Organization of African Unity, he had actually wanted a sort of Security Council component in the African Union, a military high command, so that whenever there were problems on an African country, Africans would actually go there and sort it out.
You know, I ask myself, I don't want to take away from the expertise and the skill that the Bangladeshis and the Nepalese and the Pakistanis bring in the United Nations mission in Africa. I don't want to do that.
Right.
But I would suggest to you that the Africans know their terrain. They know their people. Mm. And to see the level of professionalism, and I'm telling you that AMISOM has demonstrated the level of professionalism that our troops can bring to the battleground and to work with ordinary civilians and to actually secure lives. So for me,
terrific. In fact, even the medical service the Ugandan military doctors are conducting on the ground.
Correct.
Terrific. I wish they could also do that in Uganda, where they come from.
Fair enough.
Let me ask you a question.
Yes.
There are people who are perturbed by the fact that you actually call this a success. Mm-hmm. When it is still a work in progress. Because they point to countries like Liberia, for example.
Right.
They point to a country like Sierra Leone, where you had ECOMOG and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
And eventually, of course, you even had elections and what have you. And now you have had a sort of stable country.
Yes.
Even the Somali officials themselves will tell you that Somalia, frankly, is still, is still in trouble. It may have moved out of being a failed state.
Yes.
But it's still remarkably fragile. How would you call that a success?
Well, no
elections?
A few points. Number one.
AMISOM have been in the country for 9 years.
Yeah, but
they have not been able to, frankly, train and help to create an indigenous
Somali National Army.
Precisely.
Fair enough. But here is where the word success for me comes in. You have to see where Somalia was in 2007.
We see
As
that.
I said, was terrible.
We see that.
To be able to bring at least some semblance of law and order, where yes, Al-Shabaab still comes and does its things and kill people, but
and blows hotels
and blows
stuff
hotels
like that,
and
yes.
so on. That still occurs, but Somali, people are able to move on. But I want to also talk about the level of the multinational nature of this operation. Let me just finish.
Unfortunately, you see, we have to go to the lifeline of the show, which is the telephone callers, because at least, in terms of the context of democracy, these people also
want to
be on the radar.
Yeah, yeah.
I hope you don't mind,
enough,
my brother.
Right. No, not at all.
Good evening, Tafa from Ghana. You are most welcome to Straight Talk Africa.
Hello, good evening, Shaka.
How are you?
I'm great, Shaka. What are you, sir?
Your question, my brother, you have a minute.
Thank you very much. My question goes to our guest. We had a report about the companies working in Somalia bribing Al-Shabaab either to get a protection. And my question is that I heard your guest talk about filling stations operating without being blown out. Don't you think that what we are hearing might be true, because the filling stations owners are paying Al-Shabaab either to keep their businesses going? And secondly, don't you think Ugandan president took a political issue than reality going to help to resolve the issues bothering the Somalian people? Because if you compare what happened in West Africa, how Rawlings and other people able to bring peace in Sierra Leone and Liberia, and for 9 years now, we don't have peace in Somalia. I think something wrong somewhere. The leaders in Uganda and other countries rather took a political reason which will benefit them back home than going to help the people in Somalia. Don't you think that is a reality? Thank you very much, Shaka.
You're most welcome, Tafa. Let's go to Uganda, your country. Good evening, Richard. You're most welcome to Straight Talk Africa.
Yes, good evening, Shaka. How are you?
I'm hugely terrific. How are you today, Ndugu?
We are very fine in Kampala here. It's been a while we have not been talking. Now, my greetings to Comrade Ali Madi, Comrade in Arms.
Thank you.
And also to Mr. Opiyo Oloya. First of all, just like Comrade Ali Madi said, the Uganda government is using the diplomats in Somalia as a shield and blackmail. You see, Shaka, whenever the international community tries to, and mostly the European Union, tries to blame the Ugandan authorities on the police brutality or human rights abuse, then the Ugandan government under Museveni tries to threaten that they are withdrawing from Somalia. And then the international community takes a stand and decides to keep quiet. Now, another thing, Mr. Opiyo Oloya, you failed to analyze one thing in your book. These soldiers have had a lot of problems. For 9 months, you cannot imagine that those people who are moving, in bullets and IEDs are all over, they have not been paid for 9 months.
That is true.
It's on record. They have not been paid, okay? And the commanders of AMISOM and mostly the Ugandan contingent are selling fuel and weapons to the enemy. We have them here in court. Eh? We have them here being tried in court. Mr. Opiyo Oloya, you did not see that.
That's, I mean, your
the
point
problem
is
you were indented. Just like Ali Madi said, had you gone there privately, you would discover, you would unleash a lot of problems.
Thank you. Thank you, Richard. The point is, he went there the way he did.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a saying, of course, that you go to war with the army that you have,
yes,
not the one you wish you had.
Of course.
Your
no,
reaction?
No. I'm going to start with Richard because
Just 2 minutes, please.
2 minutes, yeah. Okay. I'll make it quick. Now, Richard, here is the reality. My book covers the period from 2007 to 2014, number one. Some of the problems that you're talking about, in fact, I preface this show by talking about them. When I went back to Somalia, I found that, yes, there were some soldiers who were actually being tried in a court-martial because of doing this or doing that, you know, mm-hmm. trying to sell some little things or there, you know, that they are not supposed to do. They were being tried. Uganda is the only contingent right now, the only troop contributing country that has got a court martial in place to try soldiers for any wrongdoing that they undertake in Somalia. So that is there. The payment, that was an issue that I found very much evident, that soldiers had not been paid. I understand they have been paid now, but there is still a part of their arrears that the European Union needs to put forward.
They just contributed
absolutely.
$200 million.
So, Richard, I agree with you that soldiers need to be paid and they need to be paid promptly. I'm not going to disagree with that.
Yes.
But when you talk about, you know, other issues such as, you know, soldiers, committing crimes and not being, those crimes not being addressed, those are being addressed, especially the Ugandan, as I said, the Ugandan contingent is addressing those issues on the spot.
Let me ask you this this question, really, Dr. Lawyer.
Yes.
Talk to me about Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni's impeccable leadership skills that you discuss in the book, especially on page 57.
Mm.
You portray him as his own man and want to speak his mind with brutal clarity. Mm. President Museveni was far from being a stooge for American foreign policy or anyone else. Instead, his involvement in Somalia was a commitment born out of deep ideological conviction that predated the American mess in Somalia.
Yes. You know, the interesting thing that many people do not know, and I ask them to read Black Hawk's Rising, is that America was opposed to the intergovernmental
initially
authority on the development from sending their troops.
In but fact, who came up with the initiative? You say it was President Museveni.
Yes, but my sources tell me
it was Washington. Yeah. It was Jindai Fraser.
No, in fact, you know, Museveni and Mwai Kibaki had worked with the Somalis, Somali people in Nairobi, and come up with the idea that there is need for a force to at least go and protect the transitional federal government.
Mm-hmm.
America was opposed to this. They lobbied the European Union not to fund that mission.
Yeah, but they later shifted the goalposts. They shifted the goalposts, first of all, December 2006. Requested that the Ethiopians cross the border.
Right.
When things went bad, they decided to come with AMISOM. And they were looking for African countries ready to go in.
But that's what I'm trying to tell you. So when people say that Museveni is a stooge of America, I disagree with that. At least the evidence is not there. Because America was against Museveni and those African leaders who were committed to sending troops to.
I see.
You see? So it was not because America came calling there and Museveni went and sent troops. No.
Unfortunately, the time happens and don't
right,
your best
right,
ally.
Right.
What about you, Milton? Your reaction?
Sadly, I believe that indeed General Museveni is a stooge of the United States, whether by design or whether by practice and history. His involvement in the Congo and the deaths of 7 million Congolese would not be tolerated if Museveni was not seen as somebody who is useful to U.S. interests in the region. He deploys in Somalia. The United States likes that because rather than have U.S. soldiers dying, we have Ugandan soldiers dying. So in that sense, whether he likes it or not, he actually serves as a stooge for the United States interests, unfortunately.
Talking about that, do we know how many people have actually lost their lives? Apparently, AMISOM does not release that list.
But Dugu Shaka, let us be clear. Are we going to sit here and say that because African leaders decided to intervene to save the situation in Somalia, therefore, those African leaders who committed their time and efforts and their people to that mission are stooges? I don't think so.
I think
we need to begin.
I didn't say that.
No, I know you didn't. But what I'm trying to say here is that at some point, we, the Africans, we need to begin to take ownership.
Precisely.
We cannot wait for America to come and lead the way and say, okay.
I like the fact, for example, that Museveni is a brutally frank man, frankly.
He is.
And he's very proud of that.
Right.
But why does he deny that privilege to others, his own people, who he says he leads? I was, for example, a moderator of a debate.
Mm.
I was specifically denied to ask my own president a question.
Okay, well, I don't know what happened there, Shaka. I can't speak for Museveni. I'm just speaking about his commitment to AMISOM, and that's what I'm going to stick with. About your
Ndugu
debate.
Lawyer.
Yes, yes.
Can I ask
yes,
one
please,
question?
Please, yes, yeah, yes, please.
You have a minute.
In 2005,
right,
the International Criminal Court started investigation of alleged crimes by Uganda's soldiers in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. And according to an article in the Wall Street Journal, June 8, 2006, General Museveni himself called then UN Secretary General Kofi Annan and told him to block that investigation. And there was allegedly evidence that would have implicated Uganda and the Commander-in-Chief, meaning Museveni might have been indicted. Only two countries have the power to block that investigation, either the United States or the United Kingdom. That investigation was blocked.
I hate to say it, but
if Museveni was not a stooge of the U.S., that investigation would never have been blocked.
I hate to say it, but time is not our best ally.
Oh.
On that note, thanks to our distinguished guests, Dr. Opiyo Oloya, educator, researcher, and author, and Milton Alimadi, founding publisher and editor, Black Star News, who joined us from New York. Thanks to our affiliate stations, along with our viewers and listeners, we thank you for tuning in. For many of our Voice of America radio affiliates, Learning English is coming up next. And tomorrow morning, it's Daybreak Africa with James Bate. On behalf of the Voice of America, thanks for tuning into Straight Talk Africa. In the meantime, get better, not beta, Uganda. And please remember to keep the African hopes alive.